At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter, @NewstalkScience. For months, we've been working on this project and so delighted to actually have it finished, because on this week's program, we have a very special episode on our brain's ability to remember faces. We're going to be talking about face blindness and super recognition. First, though, we're going to look back at the week's science news, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Lara, has to do with embryos.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really interesting piece of news that's just come out. So there is a body called the International Society for Stem Cell Research, and it's a body made up of experts in the field of, obviously, stem cell research. And back in the 80s, they made a sort of a diktat, if you will, that said that it would be unethical to grow a human embryo in vitro. So remember, that's in the lab, beyond 14 days. And the reason that they said this at the time is because they decided that that was when personhood began, because it was the point at which an embryo could no longer split to viably make twins. So they said, look, this is why you can grow to only 14 days. And this was an ethical decision. It's not a legal decision, but an awful lot of countries, so for instance, the UK, Australia, then made that part of their law. Now, back when these rules came in, or these ethical guideline, as it were, you could only grow an embryo to approximately 5 days. And this has changed drastically since then. So in about 2016, people were then able to grow them to 13 days. And the technology is advancing all the time. And this body, this International Society for Stem Cell Researchers, have come out now saying, we don't think this is a valid rule anymore. We think ethically, and I'm not entirely sure how they've decided that their ethics have changed in 30 to 40 years, but they're saying, This should not have a hard stop anymore. Every bit of research should be taken based on, obviously, the laws of the local jurisdiction. That's the most important thing, because if you were to grow an embryo to 15 days, if you were in the UK, for instance, that would immediately be breaking the law. But what they're saying is that if your research is valid enough, important enough, and it's able to go through a rigorous enough ethical assessment, you should be allowed to grow an embryo for longer. And what they're saying is this will gain us a huge amount of insight into, for instance, things like recurrent miscarriages, which are extraordinarily difficult for women, and obviously, I'm sorry, for men as well, who are going through this, as well as things like congenital abnormalities, and would help to safely study things like mitochondrial replacement therapy. So when women have perfectly normal DNA, however, their mitochondria has a problem in it, it's a way for the mitochondria, which is a little tiny organelle inside the cell, to be replaced. So they're talking about day 14 to day 28 window, which they think, which frankly is absolutely essential for human development. And they think that people should be allowed to research it now.
At what stage does this clump of cells become anything remotely recognizable? Organs, heart beating, sensory things, like that presumably is way down the line from
it's not really
days.
Johnny, to be honest, I mean, at 6 weeks you can have a heartbeat, so they're talking about maybe going up to 4 weeks, and when we say 6 weeks, it's a little bit confusing, because if a woman is 6 weeks pregnant, she's actually only had the fetus inside her for 4 weeks, because you don't, the first 2 weeks, I know it sounds strange, but pregnancies are dated from the first day of your last period, but you don't ovulate for approximately 14 days after that. So actually these embryos would be reasonably advanced. And by 12 weeks, which again, the 12-week pregnant woman, that embryo has only existed for 10 weeks. all of your organs are fully formed. So I mean, when you're only 14 days, you've actually formed the three basic layers of human. So ectoderm, where you get your skin, your brain, mesoderm, where you get muscles, bones, and your endoderm, where you get your lungs, your gut, your bladder, all of those internal organs. Those are formed after 14 days. But by 6 weeks pregnant, you can and often do have a heartbeat. So it's embryos develop extraordinarily quickly. So this is ethically very, very difficult. So I suppose, look, I mean, I'm not proffering opinion one way or the other on any of this. And I think their point is that every single bit of research should be taken individually. It shouldn't just be a blanket ban anymore. But yeah, embryos develop extraordinarily quickly.
I don't say this very often on the program, but you know an extraordinary amount of stuff. I've never said that to you. I mean, wow. Okay.
You say it maybe once every 2 years, so I'm just going to record that and play it back.
Take it while you can. Shane, who also, in fairness to him, and I'm being generous today, also knows a lot of stuff. This is a story about our universe that once was hidden, and now a team of physicists are trying to shed light on the darkest part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel nervous now after what you just said about knowing stuff, because this story is about dark matter and Einstein's theory of general relativity, which must be amongst the toughest parts of any physics curriculum. So our listeners will be very familiar with the idea of dark matter, something that we cannot see, something that we barely understand, but we know it's there because of its effects. Gravitational effect. So this is matter that's in the universe. And whilst we can't see it with our eyes, we can notice it's there because it has a gravitational effect. What scientists have done recently, a huge international group, is they've done something called a dark energy survey. So they've looked at 1/8 of the Earth's sky, and they've looked at a whopping 100 million galaxies. And they've looked at the effects of dark matter. And that this matter can actually, it's able to deviate light. It has that strength of gravitational effect that it can deviate light. And so they're able to tell where it is by looking at the deviation of light from stars. And the map they've produced shows that dark matter is not distributed in the universe evenly. There are areas of high density, and then there are these areas that they call cosmic voids. And it is this difference between the areas of high density and the areas of absence that's causing them confusion, because what they have observed does not match with the best theories we had. So the prediction didn't turn out to be true. And now we're wondering, is the prediction wrong, or is the data analysis somehow wrong?
If you're on Twitter, you can go to @NewsTalkScience and you'll see this this map of that field of vision that Shane talked about. And you can see there's sort of clumps of this dark matter all centered around some parts. And then other parts, as you say, are just sort of empty. I say empty, yeah. Empty because we think of space as empty, but space also contains dark matter, theoretically. So these seem both empty of matter and also empty of dark matter. Does that make sense?
Exactly. Yes, it does. You know a lot of stuff, Jonathan. Do you know that?
All right, we've broken it. Forget it.
But yes, this is very interesting. I think that the people working in this part of physics are getting in on the maybe we have new physics gig that we've heard a lot of recently. So those working in particle physics have been saying it a lot. Now those working in relativity are saying it too. Cosmologists, we call them.
Lara, our third story is a really interesting one because it gives us an idea as to how adaptive species might be when it comes to climate change, because we, as we've talked about many times on this show, and everyone's talking about it, there's a disappearance of species happening at a terrifying rate at the moment, and we just assume that that's going to continue, but some species are more adaptable to it than others.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're talking about is this massive loss of biodiversity. And it's coming around primarily due to climate change and also human behaviour. And it's so terrifying in so many ways. I mean, one of the most terrifying things is, for instance, the loss of the insect biodiversity, because without them, I'm afraid there is no us. So it is a really important thing to try and tackle. And these researchers from McGill University looked at a type of fish. It's called a three-spine stickleback. And this little guy is very resilient, and they're very, very adaptable. And they know this because this one breed of animal has many different shapes, sizes, and different behaviors depending on the exact environment they find them in. These fish can either be freshwater also or saltwater, which is quite remarkable for one species of fish to be able to live in either. Now, not the individual fish itself, but different, different little groups of the fish can live in either freshwater or saltwater. So what they did was they went out to the Californian coastline and they looked at six different populations of fish which were in estuaries. California and many parts around the world are very important because of the huge seasonal shifts. They have very wet winters in some of these areas, but very, very dry summers. So the fish have to live through these huge changes that are not as in terms of climate change, we're talking about years. This is within seasons. So these animals are already living through these shifts. And what they did was they took a number of the fish from each population before the start of the year. And then at the end of the season changes, they took another few fish from the population and they essentially blended them and they looked at their DNA. And what they found was that even in one season, there was a change in the genes that were expressed the most commonly, as in the animals that had survived. And what they did was they then looked at well-established populations of, say, freshwater versus saltwater three-spine stickleback. And they found that the population that had survived in these just this one season were actually very similar to the ones that had evolved separately. And they've said now that this is a way of predicting who will survive in terms of climate change. If you can look back, look at the animals that are already adaptable, that they know are shifting with the times, shifting with the seasons, then they can predict what kind of changes will need to happen to keep these animals alive in the future. I don't think it has huge applicability. I think that the headline is a bit more dramatic than the actual reality of it. I mean, we know that adaptable animals are the ones that are going to be more likely to survive. So I suppose what they're saying is, we can look at this to look back, to look forward. But at the end of the day, most animals aren't adaptable. Most can't change within a season and most will die with climate change if we don't do something about that. Mm. So, yes, predicting the ones that can survive is great, but stopping climate change would be better.
Yeah, it seems to be the final line in almost all of our stories. Just a point on that, you're not talking about gene expression changing within the lifetime of one animal, or are you?
No, so I'm not. What I'm talking about is the ones that are surviving. So what they're doing is they're looking at the population at the start and then the population at the end. Right. It's essentially natural selection,
yeah,
so survival
evolution.
Of the fittest. Exactly, it's evolution, but in a very short time frame, which is also very interesting.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with the annoying sound of people while they eat.
And whilst I'm having flashbacks of Jerry Ryan on the radio many years ago, he used to eat his toast and slurp his coffee. I also, like many listeners, would recognise that it's very annoying what you're doing, Jonathan, which is making a load of noise as you eat. Some people find that so annoying, they actually have a condition called misophonia. I would have thought that almost everyone in certain contexts finds people eating near them irritating. Have you ever been on a train hour and someone starts eating crisps across from you? Or the worst, when I lived in London, people get on the bus with the flipping McDonald's. Mm. Like that kind of stuff. But seemingly there is a medical thing called misophonia, which is the hatred of particular sounds. And some researchers have just published in the Journal of Neuroscience from Newcastle that some people who have misophonia there might be a basis for this hatred. They found by putting undergraduate students into functional MRI scanners that if they have misophonia, that certain parts of their brain light up when they're in the MRI compared to those who don't have it and they don't get this lighting up. They saw that...
Is that in any way surprising?
Well, perhaps not. I suppose, neuroscientists have a lot of these expensive MRIs and they have to do something with them. So they put their undergraduate students into them and they said that some brains had a stronger link between the part of the brain that processes sound and the part of the brain that controls the mouth and throat movement, which is the premotor cortex. So they reckon that this is a triggering sound for them. And so if you hear the sound that annoys you, it triggers a part of your brain that's normally associated with the movement of your throat and your mouth. And it sort of overactivates it, such that people who have this condition say that it feels like the sound is coming in on them. Now, it doesn't actually make them start chewing themselves or, you know, activating their own throat. Instead, it produces an urge to do so, and that urge can be quite annoying for them. Very thoughtfully, these researchers have said this experiment may lead to training for people who have this phobia, so they could learn not to have a response. So it is the perfect example, in my estimation, of having an expensive piece of equipment, looking for something to do, using your own undergraduate students to do it, and then coming up with a therapy for something that probably didn't need a therapy in the first place.
It sounds like a project that would not feature in the BT Young Scientist earliest year. Like, it wouldn't make the cut for like first year BT Young Scientist. That I don't think. Well, Dr. Steinbergen, Dr. Dara Dongam, it's been fantastic having you. Thank you so much.
Oh, God, he's the worst.
Right. Coming up, we have a lovely piece for you looking at face blindness and super recognizers. You're going to love it. Don't go anywhere. You're in a crowded bar, killing some time. Cold beer in hand, COVID a long distant nightmare. You're sitting on a stool, idly peeling the top off a bar mat when you get a tap on the shoulder. You turn around and there's a man, arms wide, big smile on his face, and he says your name like you're the best of friends. But you have no idea who this person is.
I grew up in Lucan, so just a bit outside Dublin, and like I think my childhood was pretty normal. You know, I like a fairly close group of friends my whole life. I'm still friends with a lot of them now. And with regards to my condition, I was completely oblivious to it until my late 20s. Like, there are things with hindsight that I realised like weren't normal. But I never spoke about them. I never really talked about them too much. My name is Colin Marr and I have prosopagnosia. I have this memory of when I was maybe 6 or 7, and like a woman approached me and told me, come into my car. You'll be picked up in a while. Like, your mother's running late. It turned out that this was absolutely fine. She was telling the truth, but I had no idea who the woman was. And I really, really shouldn't have done that, even though it worked out well, or asked her who she was.
As a standalone incident, Colin's story sounds pretty innocuous, but this sort of confusion was a regular feature of his childhood.
Until my late 20s, I would have just thought, you know what, I'm rubbish with faces. So when I moved to the UK, which was in 2009, when I was around 27, 28, I found myself with an entirely different circle of friends. And I just noticed myself not recognising people all the time.
Prosopagnosia is an inability to recognise familiar faces, but it can also be associated with other types of impairments. So an inability to perceive differences between two faces, for example, which tells us that it's something to do with not just memory, but really the way the visual brain works and how it dissociates one face from the next. My name is Fiona Newell. I'm Professor of Experimental Psychology at the Institute of Neuroscience in Trinity College, and I'm interested in human perception. Being able to recognize a face is really fundamental to us as social animals. And in fact, most social animals that we know of have a region that's dedicated to perceiving faces. Even sheep have neurons in their brain that respond to faces, and other sheep faces, and even human faces.
It's hard for someone like Colin to tell us how he experiences the world, because he's always been that way. He has developmental prosopagnosia, which is why it took him so long to realize that his brain worked slightly differently. When you look at someone's face, Do you see all the features as solid? Because I know there are some brain conditions where the pieces are jumbled. When you look at my face, do you see eyes, nose? Are these memorable at the moment for you?
Yeah, absolutely. But like, I don't know how I describe you. I suppose a bit of stubble. I don't know whether you, like, your nose looks any bigger or smaller than anyone else's. I think maybe people make mental notes of these things. I couldn't tell you. I don't know. Like, I don't know what the world looks like for you.
Do you see races?
Do I see races? Yeah.
If I showed you a picture of Barack Obama, would you recognize it?
Yeah.
Would you be able to recognize me if you met me again?
No.
Prosopagnosia is often referred to as face blindness, but I don't like that term too much because it doesn't really tell us about the condition. It's definitely not the case that they cannot see faces. They can. It's just that, and it's not that they, you know, that there's a total blindness to faces. What it means, it's a clinical term, which means that you are worse than what would be expected in the average population at this task. Okay, so it doesn't mean that you're totally unable to do it. It just means you're worse.
The wild thing about people who experience prosopagnosia is that they have no problems with other things. They can recognize cars, buildings, their keys, for example. But show them the face of a good friend and they can draw a complete blank.
I remember one of the most embarrassing examples was just, you know, I was walking in the park, and it was in London on a sunny day, and I got this girl in, and she was like, "So how's it going?" And then I just went blank, and I thought, "There's no, I've got nothing here. I've got no questions to ask you." So I just had to I just had to say, I'm really sorry. I don't know who you are." She was shocked, and she's like, it's Sue Ann. Like, it's like, oh, I'm really, really sorry. And then it's just like, listen, I'm really, really bad with faces. Because I think some people tell me that other people do this, and it's a kind of like, oh, well, yeah, I wouldn't know who you are, you know. And like, obviously, that's not the impression I want to give. But I think when people can see how embarrassed I am, it helps me. You know, because it's not me being aloof. It's just me being who I am.
Colin's prosopagnosia is mildly embarrassing, but it clearly doesn't distress him. That's not always the case, though.
And it can be really devastating for somebody who has prosopagnosia that, you know, from one minute to the next, they don't recognize the familiar people that surround them every day. So it's an impairment. You can be born with it, or you can acquire it. So you can sustain some brain damage to that specific region of the brain, and that then you might become prosopagnosic.
I'm Bob, and I had a stroke in 2008, and that destroyed the part of my brain that does face processing. So I've got fairly normal vision otherwise, but I can't recognise human faces. How I see faces is quite a hard thing to describe and hard to convey to other people, but what I see is completely normal. So it's exactly the same as what I saw before I had the stroke. I actually know this because, being an acquired prosopagnosic, I had 52 years of normal recognition, so I know what that's like. And then since 2008, having the inability to recognize anybody. So I can remember everything else about people as much as one does in normal interaction, but I won't recognize the face. And I understand from the neuroscientists that there is a dedicated area in our brains which recognizes human faces. And that's missing for me.
The fusiform gyrus, it's a structure in the brain that, if you imagine putting your finger over your ear parallel to the ground, it's roughly around there. And so it projects from the back of the head right to the front of the ear. And within that gyrus, which means bump in the brain, there is a region about the size of the top of your finger that we call the fusiform face area. And that region is the region that really selects faces and it processes faces. We know that the fusiform face area is responsible for face perception from a variety of sources of evidence. The first is the oldest source of evidence, and that comes from patient studies, where neuroanatomists discovered that if you damage that part of the brain, that patient is rendered with an inability to recognize faces. And a lot of that evidence came from the war, you know, soldiers having damage to their brain and suddenly they couldn't recognize the most familiar faces around them.
People do have clothing styles and there are things like postures and mannerisms. And without being rude, no face is perfect. People have odd little blemishes or features. And what I do is make notes. If I'm at a conference, I'll make discrete notes, which if anybody saw me doing it, would be very creepy because I'll be writing things like fat bald man with big wart. So I've got to be very careful that nobody sees what I'm doing. And clearly, if you didn't know why, long blonde lady with silver glasses and pink blouse, it would look, as I say, creepy if you didn't know the reason I was doing it. My daughter has got a little mole on her cheek. Without that, there are occasions when I would not have recognised her, but and particularly from photographs, I've seen groups that include my daughter and other young ladies of a similar sort of appearance, and I often can't identify which one is her.
So you can identify the mole on your daughter's face, yes. But not the face of your daughter.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Yes.
Imagine not being able to recognize your own daughter. But for me, the real brain flip of Bob's pure prosopagnosia is that it's also instant. The moment he looks away from your face, it's forgotten.
There was one occasion when I had to meet somebody in a station cafe, and I think I went up to get coffees and then came back. And I couldn't identify the person that I was with. I'd been speaking to him, went away to get the coffee, came back, and I didn't know where he was sitting and who he was. So after that, I've always been very careful to make a mental note so that I can locate where I was before, knowing now that I won't be able to recognize the person I was with.
You can imagine prosopagnosics like Bob and Colin are of some interest to psychologists and neuroscientists who are trying to understand how the brain works.
My name is Michael Ramon. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, and I'm interested in how face processing is implemented by the human brain. I became interested in face processing during my studies when I heard about newborns' preference for faces. So within even 48 hours after birth, infants tend to prefer to look at things that resemble faces. Imagine you have an oval shape with two dots in the location where eyes would be, a line and a horizontal line at the bottom. This could look more face-like than, say, a rectangle with a dot in the middle. So things that have information that's arranged in a face-like composition, they tend to prefer to look at more than other stuff. I'm a trained neuropsychologist, and I did my degree in psychology, and I have a PhD in neuroscience. So I kind of try to combine all the methods and skills that I've picked up along the way. And what type of methods or experiments I do really is determined by the question. So if I'm interested in looking at individual fixation strategies, obviously I will use eye tracking as my method of choice in that context. If I'm trying to understand differences in the performance between prosopagnosics and normals, maybe I'll do an experiment that only taps into behavior in a first instance.
By comparing neurotypical brains to those of prosopagnosics, we can start to piece together how our minds identify and store memories of faces.
there's two types of tests going on memory. There is one which I call the Grant Mitchell face test, because it's, they showed you pictures of just bland faces with no facial hair and bald, and to me they all look like Grant Mitchell, but I think other people could say they don't look anything like Grant Mitchell, but it was just a screen full of Grant Mitchell's. And then I have to, like, I press a button when I notice the same face coming up again.
One of these tests that Colin took part in threw up a rather interesting discovery. Colin can't even recognise his own face.
I was asked to shave my beard and then go in and do a study. And then they were showing me faces, and one of the faces was mine. And I didn't pick up on that straight away, but I did by the time the study was complete.
What I've done mostly in these experiments is be shown a computer screen with lots of different artificially created faces. So they're computer generated images. And the tests involve things like being shown a face and then being shown five faces, and you have to say which of the five was the one you saw before. And I get appalling scores doing that. And then they've done other tests where they show something like, and there's been some variance on that, so they show upright and inverted faces, because no human being can identify inverted faces properly. So I come out like the controls with upside down faces.
Funnily enough, that's not entirely true. There are some people who can recognize faces very, very well, even inverted ones. They're called super recognizers.
So what we're not very good at is matching faces that are unfamiliar to us. For instance, if I show you a picture of your mother at the age of 3, you will be able to recognize her despite never having had seen this picture before. However, if I show you an infant picture of myself, since you don't know me well, it's very unlikely that you'd be able to identify me on that picture. Super recognizers are pretty good at this. For instance, one of the super recognizers that I work with reported that she had recognized someone at an international airport in Germany who she had only briefly seen once at a hotel in Turkey. And this was really impressive because she had A, never actually interacted with this person, B, she recognized them in an unexpected and unlikely context, and C, she had seen this person as a child 10 years prior.
As someone who is bad with faces, this is astonishing to me. I had to speak to a super recognizer, and I found one.
My name is Lauren, and from Scotland. I suppose I've always known I was a super recognizer, but I didn't really know it had a title like that. I grew up watching programs like Crime Watch and just absolutely loved identifying people, and just thought I would love to do that one day. You know, I could recognise just random people from that I'd maybe only seen once, just something that I guess I've always had.
Lauren has lots of stories like the one of the lady in the airport, but the one that really got me going was this one.
A few years ago, when I met one of my friends, who happens to be one of my best friends now, I met her in my early 20s. And one of the first things I'd said to her was, oh yeah, I've definitely met you before, I've seen you before. I described her, she was walking down a particular street in Glasgow. She had dreadlocks at the time and no interaction at all. We hadn't spoken. It was just, she'd literally walked past me and she said, what? I just can't. At this point, she had this long glamorous hair, but I just remembered her walking down the street years before with her dreadlocks in, and it was her. She just couldn't believe it that I had remembered her all these years later.
So the maths on this are hugely individual and not great, to be honest, but we've guesstimated that the average person can remember about 5,000 faces, but that's remembering a face that presumably you have some interaction with over your entire life. But in terms of faces we just see in a flash, like Lauren describes, how is it possible that the brain can remember a face it saw years ago in a totally different environment for a heartbeat? Micah says we just don't know yet.
At the moment, there are roughly, I don't know, some 20, 25 papers on the topic of super recognizers in the scientific literature. And a lot of these don't actually report empirical data. So it's like commentaries or reviews. So there's a lot of work to do. And that's why I'm looking into this.
That said, Micah's work has shown that for super recognizers, when they see a face, the activity is very different to neurotypical brains.
Yes, my collaborators and I have recently found exactly this. So we do have evidence to think that super recognizers' brains are fundamentally different or process facial information in a different way. So we used electroencephalography or EEG to measure electrical activity from the scalp. And we then showed observers images of faces and objects like over 3,000 times per participant. And we measured how the brain responds to each of these events, let's say. And what we found is that super recognizers and controls brain patterns are different from as early as 70 milliseconds after an image is presented.
So we know one thing. There is a spectrum. And wherever you sit on it, something interesting happens when you look upon a face. And even if you are at the extreme end, you're not alone. Lauren, our super recognizer, used to work with someone who had face blindness.
I actually worked with a girl who was the complete opposite of me. She had face blindness, and there were a few awkward moments at that point. We worked in a school, and during school pickup, parents would come to pick up their children, and she would just think, who on earth are these people? Even though they dropped their children off that morning and she knew them. So there were some a few sort of awkward moments with that. She also used to talk about unable to follow characters from scene to scene when she was watching movies. So, you know, things like that, just simple things that we take for granted, she would find quite difficult. I guess the kind of funny thing is that she would forget me in an instant, but I would never forget her face. So it's strange.
Faces was produced by myself, Jonathan McRae, and Aidan McKelvey, edited by Jonathan McRae. We'd like to thank all of our contributors, Colin Marr, Bob Cockshott, Professor Fiona Newell, Micah Ramon, and Lauren, our super recognizer. Big thanks also to everyone who gave us information and background and recorded with us, Dr. John Towler, Dr. Anna Boback, Henry McKean, Emmett Rafferty, and Tony Hickey. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. You can email your reactions to science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at @newstalkscience. I hope you enjoyed that. You can email us your reactions, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at @newstalkscience, and we'll get to those reactions in next week's podcast. Here to go through some of your comments from last week is producer Aidan McKelvey. Welcome back.
Hello.
So it's over. The months and months of working on that flippant piece, it's finally done. Were you happy enough with it in the end?
Yeah, I thought it was a lovely piece. I'm happy as well. Like, you did a lot of the work. That always makes it easier good. To enjoy, you know?
Are you good with faces?
I am. I think I'm quite good with faces. Like, one of the Lauren, I believe, our super recognizer, mentioned that thing of she'd be going down the street and she saw someone and she just saw them once and recognized them years later. I have had that. You know, I'll be walking in George's Street in Dublin and I'd be like, I know that person somewhere. Take me a while.
It's not by any chance the guy in the cap on the bike.
No.
Or is it? It's not Cricky either. Is it? There are two guys. There are two guys which myself and my wife see around Dublin, and we've seen them for the last 20 years. I mean, maybe the ghosts of Christmas past. But one is a guy, I think his name is Cricky. he used to have these notebooks, loads of these notebooks packed with notes. And he'd just walk around, cool looking guy. I bumped into a couple of times. Lovely fella. But everywhere I went, it was like, where's Wally? He was there somewhere in town. He featured at some point in the evening. And the other is this guy on a bike. And Dara and this other friend of ours, Dara, the two of them always share sightings of this guy because whenever they're in town, he's there. It's weird. But I'm actually really bad at faces. I'm not good at placing them. And when they're out of context, it's really bad. So I'm not so bad if I see someone in the normal place I expect them. But if I see someone who's normally in a uniform and then I see them out of that, or if they're in casual wear at the school and then I see them, you know, dressed up, I'm really bad. And I remember one time this woman who I had met several times through my brother, she'd sort of had enough. She said, "What the hell's wrong with you? Like, this is so rude. I've met you so many times." I wouldn't mind, but she'd just been in conversation with my wife saying, "Oh yeah, me and Jonathan go way back. We've known each other for ages. And how's this?" And how she knew all about me. And then I just joined the conversation with her and her wife and said, "Oh, hi, I'm Jonathan." And obviously this was hugely embarrassing for her. And she got very upset about it. And I, you know, the thing is, I don't want to not remember people. Like, that's not a conscious thing. It doesn't, I mean, the implication is here, I'm being an asshole. And like we heard Colin say, it's, I mean, yes, I may be an asshole, but not for that specific reason. In this particular instance, my brain has just failed to put two and two together and identify name and context and so on. And I think, you know, it's, you know, I always joke and say to people, you know, when they don't remember me, I say, I must try to be more memorable. But it's nothing to do with that. I mean, we meet so many people. I meet a lot of people, and therefore I don't feel too bad when I don't remember someone, you know?
Yeah, I don't think, like, I don't think you need to, yeah, you can't take it personally. So my relative skill in recognizing faces is completely and utterly compromised and rendered useless by my absolute inability to remember names. And like, I really infuriate my family and friends by pointing at people and go, "Oh, that guy."
I know, but that's just being
that's
a man.
And they're like, "Who?" And I'm like, "Your man."
Yeah, that's just being a man. Well, women are much better at this, I think.
I've had to work around it. Like I'm actually giving away my secret now. If I meet anyone and they say hello to me, I'll be like, I'm always like, "How's it going, man?"
I do. What I do is I bump up the familiarity by about 5%. So like, you know, if you just knew them, I always give them a little bit extra so they go, "Well, he wouldn't have been that enthusiastic to see me if he didn't remember who I was." The other thing is that sometimes, because I've done some TV, right, sometimes people will arrive at the door to deliver something, or I'll meet them, you know, out, and they'll go, "We've met before, right?" And it's a killer because I just say, "Oh yeah, maybe," or something. But I have no idea, like, if that's because they've seen me on, you know, at 4 a.m. in the morning on some crappy repeat on a channel nobody watches, or if I actually did meet them. Because I never go, "Oh yeah, I remember." I always go, "That's because I'm on TV." And it's just never because I'm on TV.
Great. I mean, I've been the opposite end of that. When I started working in News Talk, I think it was like about 2 or 3 weeks in, and I was coming towards the building and I saw this woman coming the opposite way, who at the time I was unaware was just like a kind of a model on Irish TV who I would have seen on TV. But because I had just started working in media, I thought I knew her. Like, dear. I knew the face. So I was like, "Oh, how's it going?" And I think she just thought I was some weird creep who was like saying hello to her on the street. She definitely gave me a look of like, "Who are you, you weirdo?"
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, actually. Humans are so finely tuned to social interaction that if you overdo it just a tiny bit with the hello, or you lean in a bit too much, or, you know, you spend too long maintaining eye contact, like, it takes there's a very narrow range of acceptable behavior with people. And once you go tiny bit out that, you're a total weirdo. It's mad how perfect our communications, our non-verbal communication needs to be with someone else. Right, it's time to look at some of your comments from last week. And really, you all just got in touch about the dress because we were tweeting about that. And of course, the dress, you know, this dress illusion, is it blue or brown or purple and gold? When you look at this, Isn't it white and gold? Why is someone saying purple and gold? Isn't it white and gold? Blue? Someone else is seeing something
needs
else.
Needs to seek medical attention.
Yeah, so, you know, this illusion. Whenever you mention it on the internet, people go nuts. So people are saying, you know, oh, it's obvious which one it is, and then not saying which one it was. I just can't believe that anyone doesn't see blue and black personally. But someone says, if I were to normally look at it, I only see white and gold. But if I squint my eyes and shut them nearly completely, I see blue and black. And then others say, ah, yes, some people say blue and brown, others say purple and gold. The irony, I say, when a person reads or hears these words, that's what they actually see. Now, no, if you told them, look, here's this white and gold dress, if they were going to see black and blue, they'll see black and blue anyway, I'm sure. Another says, it's not about interpretation of colours. I've seen it as both, and the change was totally radical. It was clearly deep blue and black when I saw it as such. I thought it was absurd when some people said it was gold and white. Now I see it that way. I didn't know it could change. Do you, what colour do you see?
I think it can change. Yeah, I think I saw it originally as white and gold, but it can change because it's to do with, if I remember correctly, the context of the light. So if you had been in a very dark room and then you looked at it, I think you might get a different result than if you were in a light room.
Yeah.
Because it's like your brain adjusting the ambient light and or adjusting for the ambient light and making its decision in relation to that.
I mean, loads of people have done YouTube videos that explain it much better than that. So I can't give you your time back, but if you want to really understand it, like, just go to YouTube. They do it better. I'm just being honest.
Pretty good from memory.
I'm being honest.
Yeah. That was there's my science broadcast. Got up in smoke.
Unnecessarily cruel, I think. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to the man of the moment, Aidan McKelvey, our producer, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, and Steve McClune, who was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.